chase after the Council on Foreign Relations all you want. Camp outside of some hotel where the Bilderbergers are meeting with a sign, if you'd like. I think I'd rather concentrate from now on what the soldiers of reason are doing. The Rand Corporation and the rise of the American Empire. Alex Abeya next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Alex Abeya, I not only have enjoyed reading your book, although I just got it the other day, so I haven't had a chance to finish it yet, but I also went back and read some of your columns online. I know you've got a lot to say, so let me just say up front, let it rip. Because you got a lot going on. You do a lot of research, and I think it's a very interesting opinion, so don't hold anything back.
All right.
Okay.
Soldiers, thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, good. It's a pleasure. Thank you for working it out so fast for us. That's what happens. I'll get a book like this. I think I saw this on Thursday afternoon, and then I was begging the producers, oh, could you get this guy? Oh, if you could just get this guy for this weekend. So thanks for making time for us.
No, my pleasure.
All right, so let's talk right away about a little bit about you. You're a columnist, writer, researcher. How else do you want to describe yourself for the purposes of
I don't know, jack of all trades. I write anything and everything, but lately I've been doing a lot of nonfiction. My first novel came out in a while back, and it was a New York Times notable book. But lately I've been doing nonfiction and columns because I'm really I'm really drawn to what you might call the hidden side of things, the hidden side of history. And that's what drew me to the Rand Corporation, because I just feel that he was an organization that has had such a seminal influence on world history, not just American history, but world history, and even the way we live today. And practically nobody knows about it, and they've gone out of their way to keep it hidden. And when it comes out, they wash their hands of the whole thing and says, well, we're really not that important, or we really didn't do this, didn't do that. But, the
right.
Facts say otherwise.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, they are not a hidden organization, right? I mean, you'll see Rand Corporation guys all the time on talking head shows, and there's these think tankers have been around for a while. It's not like, the Illuminati or Freemasons or Opus Dei or something where you can't ever know what's going on. It's just, in a way, they're sort of like hiding in plain sight.
That's right. That's right. But, although I beg to differ in one point, because I think that a lot of their work is still classified, top secret. So, and they still get 50% of their money and all their contracts from the federal government. So
right.
A lot of what they do, we still really don't know.
Okay.
I mean, especially with the secretive kind of White House that we have right now. I mean, for instance, there was a Rand analyst who told the Bush administration, hey, you can't trust the Saudis. I mean, with friends like the Saudis, we don't need enemies, right after 2001.
Right.
So we don't know exactly what kind of advice it is they're giving, but we know they are giving advice. The latest example is, what happened with Barack Obama, who just a couple of weeks ago was quoting a Rand study on the effects of post-traumatic stress syndrome on returning veterans from Iraq. So, they're part of the permanent government. No matter who's in, they're there.
Right. And I think that's a key part to point out, that the Democrats, Republicans, you can name lots of famous people who have served in government or run for office who came out of the Rand Corporation sort of mass mind.
Right.
Thought.
I mean, I think one of the most prominent ones is Daniel Ellsberg, who I quote at length in the book. He's a fascinating character. Your listeners probably know that Dan Ellsberg is a guy who leaked the Pentagon Papers in an attempt to stop the Vietnam War, which actually he didn't. But what he did do is set in motion the downfall of Richard Nixon, which is very curious. So be that as it may, Dan had a very astute observation, which is that the Rand Corporation has really had most of its influence not so much from the papers that it has produced as from the people that have gone through its doors.
Well, let's even push that a little bit further. That then Daniel Ellsberg on the left and people like Paul Wolfowitz on the
right,
and somehow they can come out of the same think tank.
I know, it's pretty amazing, but there it is.
Well, let's, so So let's go back to the origins of the Rand Corporation, look for the blueprint, and find out where it's gotten, where the building has gone from there.
I think that the genetic, that the DNA component is what tells you why these things happen, why the Rand Corporation is so important, because it was created, it was thought of as the civilian counterpart to the Manhattan Project. As you well know, the Manhattan Project came up with the atomic bomb. Well, there was a general in the U.S. Army Air Force back then in 1945. They were both the same. They were still allied. They were still one and the same. And he came up with the idea of having a civilian outfit like that that would, you know, come up with new weapons of war for the Air Force. At the time, you have to realize, too, that the Army Air Force, and later on the Air Force, was the most important branch of the armed forces because they were in charge of the bomb, you know, and the bombs had to be delivered by airplane. So therefore, the flyboys were the golden boys. And he wanted to preserve that. And he also wanted the Air Force to be in charge of the development of intercontinental ballistic missiles. So what he did is that he got together a group of scientists that he knew, and he cut a check for $10 million out of unused funds from the war and told these guys, okay, you know, go to town, boys. You know, you can spend this money any way you want as long as, you know, try to concentrate on ballistic missiles. And other than that, you're free to develop whatever weapons it is that you think will advance the cause of, as I say in my book, the American Empire, the American interests around the world. And
we could say freedom. I mean, we can say that to a point that it wasn't as though that they were only interested in the business side of things.
No, what do you mean by that?
Well, I just mean American empire can imply multinational corporations. Empire can be that some of them, at least maybe from the earliest years, they had altruistic intentions with that money.
Well, I am not so
sure
that the intentions are so altruistic. It depends how you define that. I mean, it was a conscious expansion of American power. However, I will say this: it was an empire of the willing. Because you had on one hand, the Soviet Union and its satellites, and people in Europe and throughout the world knew what those guys were like because they had seen that. And on the other hand, they had us. And, you know, you had to, like, go with these guys or go with the other guys. So, for instance, in Western Europe, and by the way, that's not a phrase that I coined. That was coined by a historian. You know, the empire of the willing, because they chose to follow the American lead. But still, I think it was an empire, and it still is to a very large degree.
All right, well, that's fair enough, but I think that's – sometimes when we say empire, our thoughts immediately go to, like, the evil empire, and we can get back to that later on, where people are compelled. So at least it was a choice people were making, and we were trying to develop weapons, keeping in the tradition of World War II, in that there were many people that thought this was a unique opportunity. You had brilliant men and I guess a few women from all over the country that had been brought together during the war effort, some out of academia, some out of business, and they were brought together to create the weapons that would win the war. They did. Then comes the end of the war. Those people go back to the campuses and they go back to the businesses, and it looks like this fertile opportunity where the world has gotten – it's like an Etch-a-Sketch that just got all shook up, and suddenly some forward-thinking folks are thinking, hey – We can't miss this opportunity to try to keep things heading in the right direction.
Well, yeah, you might say that, but on the other hand, why should – I mean, if you really want to get into it, why shouldn't we have then just disbanded? Why shouldn't we have just – I mean, at that point in 1945, when this whole thing starts, you know, we ruled the world, so to speak, half the world. I mean, there was no need to develop all these new weapons. What we had was more than enough.
Okay, all right. So the Rand Corporation
Oppenheimer tried to do, remember? I mean, he kept saying there's no need, for instance, to develop the hydrogen bomb, and if we don't develop it, you know, the other guys won't have to develop it either. You know, it's a way of thinking that never was tried, because the United States government deliberately went out of its way to try to expand its power. Whether it was done altruistically or not, it was a very deliberate, conscious move on the part of the Truman administration.
Right. So fair enough. So therefore, so is born then the Soldiers of Reason, the Rand Corporation.
Right.
And they we can call on that because this, as a think tank, they right away they get together, and with this $10 million check, as they use as sort of their seed money,
right.
They sit down and they start to think about what do they do. First of all, who's Rand?
Well, RAND, they came up with that name. It was just supposed to be a temporary name. It stands for Research and Development. So there is no RAND, and there is no development either. The old joke is, it's all research and no development, because all they do is come up with ideas. I mean, at one point, RAND in the 1950s could have become, what TRW was, which then became, a humongous contractor, but they deliberately chose not to because they just did not want to do applied science. They just wanted to do theory, and they just wanted to, dwell in the imperial realm of ideas.
All right. Well, what's some of the earliest ideas that they start coming up with that take hold, that take root?
Well, one of the first ones is within a month after they get set up. Let me give you the timeline. The general gets the idea in October 1945 that he's going to set it up. He cuts the check, tells everybody to go to work, and then they have to go through a whole procurement process in the U.S. Army, and they have to assign a name to it, et cetera. So actually, Project RAND, as it's first called, then comes to life in the spring of 1946. Within a month after it comes to life, they come up with this idea for an orbiting space station. Now, you have to realize that back then, first of all, we had no rockets. Second of all, the idea of having satellites in space and having much less an orbiting space station was something that belonged, in comic books and pulp fiction. And instead, these guys came up with the idea of doing it, showed how it could be done, what kind of rockets you would need, even the kind of fuel that would be necessary, and the uses to which it would be applied. Uses that today are the uses to which we apply the existing space station, which is for weather, for experiments, and also at the time for military propaganda. Because after all, if America can put up a space station like that, what can it not do? And all its enemies will quake in their boots when they see this. So all of this within a month after Project RAND gets going. Ultimately, the Truman administration decided not to do that because it was lost in politics. The reason why they had commissioned that is because the Air Force wanted to cut off at the knees a similar project that was being directed by Wernher von Braun, the guy who later became head of NASA. And that was the Navy was doing that, and the Air Force was trying, to make sure that it was the only power within that particular realm. That is, that nobody else would take anything that had to do with rockets or anything going up in the air away from them. So the project was shelved, but yet, that project made RAND's reputation. And within 2 years, the place that had started with only 4 employees, it had grown to hundreds of employees and was churning out thousands of projects.
Now, who's contributing money at this point beyond the initial $10 million?
At that point, it's just the Air Force, exclusively, practically the Air Force. I think the Air Force at that point in the first 2 years is about 90% of their budget. And they had them doing all kinds of things, studying all kinds of things, not only for weapons, but also for testing metals, for engines, all kinds of things that needed to be done. They were like the consigliere of the Air Force. Matter of fact, RAND grew so much, and it was churning out so much project that it threatened the very life of the outfit in which it was sited. Let me explain. When Project RAND came out, it was set up at Douglas Aircraft. Why? Because Mr. Douglas, a Douglas Aircraft, was the, what was he? He was related by marriage to General Arnold. His daughter had married Arnold's son. So therefore, Arnold said, okay, well, why don't you cite these guys over at your factory? Within 2 years, RAND had come up with so much work that the Air Force was not giving contracts to Douglas. And Douglas said, we can't do this because we're missing out on all these contracts because the Air Force is afraid of, of favoritism.
Right.
So therefore, RAND had to break away from Douglas and it had to incorporate. And that's when it becomes the RAND Corporation in 1948, in May of 1948.
Very interesting. Now, and there's a bunch of these kind of relationships. It's a small circle in the beginning, and then as you see it, as you say, it already sort of broadens out. We know traditionally the CIA recruits from the Ivy League. They look for certain types of, or they did at any point. They may not anymore. But during those early years of espionage, there was a certain type of a spy. Who was the type for the RAND Corporation at the beginning?
Well, that's a very, very good question. They too recruited from you know, the best and the brightest. Princeton, Yale, Harvard, Brown, MIT, Caltech.
What were they looking for out of those?
They were looking for engineers, mathematicians, physicists, mostly. Because
what about political? What would be the affiliation?
That's the main problem. In that they had somebody, for instance, named Bernard Brody, who is like the father of nuclear strategy, and he was out of Yale. And what happened is that they first started with the what you might call the mathematical or the hard sciences. And then they realized, well, you know, it's like we really don't know that much about psychology, how people will act under certain circumstances, about the human psyche, which, by the way, became their weak point and still is to a very large degree, as I'm sure we'll go into later. And then they decided to branch out into social sciences. But over time, the numerical approach to reality won out at RAND and to this very day. So, like, certain humanistic values that I think most people would think would be necessary in an organization as important as RAND are just not there.
Well, it's not just the humanistic values. There's something that goes to work right away at the RAND Corporation amongst these engineers and these mathematicians, and that's this philosophy that starts early that we're still living with today. And it's sort of the defining philosophy of the RAND Corporation that kind of guides them then for the next couple of decades. Can you talk about that?
Well, there's a couple of things that came out of that. I'm talking about the numerical approach to reality because that leads them to what you might call rational choice.
Right.
Right. Before that, they had developed something called game theory, which, as you know, those of your listeners who know the Beautiful Mind and physicists and economists and stuff like that. Again, it's a numerical approach to reality. Then they developed something called rational choice theory, which posits that all humans are self-directed and that the greatest good is that which is that for the individual and not for the collective. That is, that what is good for number one is what is the best. And this came out as a reaction to what you might call the precepts of Marxism-Leninism, which held that the collective is all and that, you know, the individuals do not matter as much. And this was developed by an economist and who later won a Nobel Prize for this. And basically what this doctrine does is that it erodes the ties that bind us together in society.
All right, hang on to that thought. We'll have to pick it up right there.
Okay, no problem.
We'll speak right there. The philosophy of RAND Corporation, which, as Alex Abeya says, erodes the ties that bind us as a society. It's a very interesting sort of glimpse. It's something that we are still working with. Soldiers of Reason, the RAND Corporation and the Rise of the American Empire continues next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Alex Abeya, the author of Soldiers of Reason. So we were talking about this idea, this rational theory, so to speak, about how we are essentially all just self-interested. And this starts really early in the RAND Corporation's outlook.
Right. Right. Starts in 1950. Before we go on, by the way, I wanted to congratulate you on your ordination.
Well, thank you. They ran out of people. I was the last. I was the last one on the list. So after that, I'm afraid there won't be anybody left.
We both belong to the same church, and I'm a lay Eucharistic minister myself. So.
Oh, are you really? Oh, way to go. So this is the cool part, though. On the, I've always had sort of the suspicion that there was somebody somewhere that had this view that said. I'm really serious. I've been thinking about this for a long time. Whose idea is it, or why does it keep coming up, that we do these things that seem completely inconsistent with our political principles? Like, for example, I don't really understand the tax rebate philosophy in stimulating the economy vis-a-vis George Bush. It just didn't seem to make any sense. Right. It's not a conservative outlook. It's nothing. You don't spend money you don't have, and clearly we didn't have the money.
Right.
So, I mean, I looked at that and I thought, well, that's got to be coming from somewhere else, and right. Now I know where it's coming from, because
right.
that ties directly back to the Rand Corporation, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, because, look, this came out in 1950. Came out of an attempt by Western intellectuals to face up to the threat of the Soviet Union. As I was saying before, you know, Soviet-style communism, you know, with its faith in a Hegelian movement of history, you know, a lot of people thought that was the way for the future. So they had to come up with an idea that would be able to counteract that, because according to communism, you know, it's a collective that is important, and the collective will is the ruling principle of society, which, you know, this was like against all, you know, American notions of free will, individual rights, and limited government. So, you know, there was a guy named Kenneth Arrow who at Rand had been assigned a particular job. Now, this is kind of funny, because the job was the following. He was to decide how would the collective leadership of the Soviet Union react in case there was a war. Why did he have to do this? Because at the time we had no spies in the Soviet Union. We had no idea what was going on in the Kremlin. The people that we thought we had were actually feeding us false information. So the Rand Corporation then was assigned the job of trying to decide how would the Soviet Union act in case, you know, for instance, we went to war over Korea or something like that. So Arrow was given the function of given the job of finding a utility function that is to define in formal mathematical terms how people would act under certain circumstances. So he took a number of assumptions, you know, that people are rational, that self-interest is what guides everyone, and that rationality is the same, that scientific principles are universal. And when he came up, we came up with something called, Arrow's theorem, which basically said that if you have two people making, ranking in order of preference more than three things, there can be no agreement unless one of them imposes his will on the other, which means there is no such thing as a collective decision that's done according to free will.
That's voluntary. There's no voluntary collective.
Exactly. Which, right. Of course, you know, to me, it's like this is crazy. It's like, you know, we're going down the rabbit hole here.
Well, hold on a second. Stop. Why do you call that crazy? I'm curious about that, because I would think that the totalitarian regimes prove that true, that people are forced to want to drive bad cars, and so those are the cars that they value. That they'll talk about the Soviet cars during the period that's the best cars on the planet, only because they were forced to drive them. They didn't have a choice to make an individual expression. You see what I mean? I mean, I think that there's some truth to that, isn't there? That you can.
I disagree, because you see what the Arrow's theorem posits. I mean, if you take it to its extreme, which is what a lot of people do, especially
okay.
The people who hijack the theory, is that there is no such thing as you say as a voluntary accord. That everything is imposed on you, and you know that means, for instance, I mean, we do agree on elections, right? And we
right.
do believe in religion. You and I and a lot of people
right.
in this country, you know, we do
okay.
believe in God. So there's something that goes beyond this. We aren't just self-directed individuals, atoms in this universe. We have a purpose. There's something else to life, and there's something that goes beyond us. Of course, we're also human, which means we also have that aspect as well. But to think that we're exclusively that way is, you know, what leads us to, you know, Ronald Reagan saying, you know, government is a problem and not the solution. Because then that means that there is no such thing as patriotism, because politicians are just seen as self-interested actors who are only there to expand the government power or to follow the dictates of a particular group. And therefore, there's no such thing as thinking of the collective of other people, because you're only thinking about yourself all the time, so therefore you cannot trust the government. And then when it's applied to corporations, it says, well, all that counts is, you know, the shareholders. When for decades in this country and in the Western world, corporations, you know, it's like the dictum what Alfred P. Sloan said about GM. You know, what's good for GM is what's good for the country, because they were part of a certain country. They were followed. They would try to create the social conditions
right.
in which they found themselves. And they're not just detached beings that exist in a vacuum where the only thing that they owe it is an obligation to the shareholders. They have social responsibilities. But rational choice theory redeems them of that responsibility.
Let me jump in there and say that maybe this phrases it differently, but and then you tell me how this is wrong, that what you're saying is that we can't get ultimate agreement, that in order for everybody to agree on the same thing, you have to impose your will on somebody else, that's the belief. Because it seems like there are some things that you and I will voluntarily agree on, and other things that it makes it very hard in our country sometimes people experience difficulty in disagreeing, that you stigmatize disagreement as a way of trying to impose a certain will. And I think back on the war, when the whole thing was if you disagreed at all about going to war, you were unpatriotic, and that you were labeled.
Well, I think that's bull feathers. From my point of view, I mean, anybody who says that is just ridiculous. I mean,
right? But doesn't
right
that
to disagree? But yet you abide by these decisions.
Okay. But I'm just saying, doesn't that speak to this idea about imposing your will on other people? It's ultimately a cynical view, and that cynical view says that as long as you're feeding the individual, as long as the individual feels like they're in charge and they're getting what they wanted, they're less interested in having to worry about other things like world problems or health problems
exactly,
are getting solved.
Because then it leads to a consumer society, a society
right.
in which the people who live within that society are no longer seen as citizens, that is, people who have rights and obligations, but as consumers who are self-directed, who are only trying to get the best for themselves.
Well, that's kind of like bread and circuses, then. I mean, it's sort of the Roman idea.
Yes, right. Exactly, and that's what leads to totalitarianism, and that's so antithetical to all American principles. That's not what this country is about,
agree
with.
Right. And in your research of the Rand Corporation, you're saying this was their philosophy from the beginning, that if you just keep people fat and happy on self-interested things, you can get away with a lot of stuff.
Well, I'm not saying that they put it so bluntly, but that's exactly
okay.
what it leads to. And when certain very powerful economic interests in the 1970s and 1980s hijacked that particular theory, that's exactly what happened. Thus, you have deregulation of financial markets, which, you know, obviously we're living now with that particular disaster, with, you know, the subprime loan disaster that we have right now, and the banking deregulation, that leads to a number of things that have affected us so much. I mean, even down to toll roads, you know, whoever thought of in any case.
We can get back to toll roads. I have sort of a thing about toll roads, so I think they're an interesting metaphor, but hang on to that. We'll get back to it later on.
No problem.
So in the 50s, then, Alex Abeya here, the author of Soldiers of Reason, says the Rand Corporation starts with this philosophy on self-interested citizens. And basically, just kind of if you use that philosophy, then you can do a lot more. You can do a lot of interesting things. And this seeps into the general American government
right, exactly.
view outlook. All right. So what's the earliest form that sort of bread and circuses philosophy? Where do you see it in its earliest incarnation?
Well, I see it myself in the whole rise of the consumer society. Because after all, this is what Kenneth Arrow, who was the Nobel Prize-winning economist, comes up with. You know, he calls it the sovereignty of the consumer. And that's how we became a consumer society. I mean, what it did is that it took certain tendencies that already existed within American society and accelerated them. It's like they put them on steroids and said, oh, this is what we got to do. It changed so many things. But specifically, let's get back to brass tacks here, down to brass tacks. I would say that, you know, it all comes to a head in the late 1950s, early 1960s. I mean, when you have the glorification of consumerism to the detriment of certain other
aspects of society.
Aspects of society. I mean, just look at Mad Men. I mean, it's a fascinating show. That, you know,
the TV series.
But,
the
you know,
TV
because,
series.
You know, I remember those times, even though I was just a little kid. But, you know, it's that beginning of that changeover of our country. Becoming, instead of being citizens, we become consumers. And, you know, that's the path to ruin.
That's a very interesting idea, because I think that if you, I know when I've talked to seniors, they do talk about that era of consumerism and how it changed the world that they remembered from the Depression or from the war, when there was a lot more of sort of a public concern. And we spike up that way a little bit. But even when you look at 9/11,
right,
the response was, if you want to fight terrorism, go buy a car.
I know. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's so odd. So, but I mean, I could see the logic of that. If you want to fight terrorism, don't let our economy fail. Don't let these businesses go out. You got to go out and spend money to help. I mean, I get the logic of it, but it's still, it seemed like such a shallow response to something really profound.
And again, you know, it follows the whole rationale of rational choice theory. And,
yeah,
you know, you have to appeal to people. You don't want them making sacrifices because people are not going to make sacrifices. Right? Of course, you know, we know that's not true. We know that people will make sacrifices. That's the problem we've been having in Iraq too, until very recently. You know, we have people who are willing to die, you know, commit suicide for their cause because they believe in something greater than themselves.
And I'll even push that even further to go back to the idea of the tax rebates.
Yeah.
Our answer to our economic woes isn't save more money, start building your nest egg, take care of your own retirement first. It's not that. It's suckle, you know, harder and faster at the teat of consumerism, because that is what you can do as an individual to help. So go out and spend this tax money we're going to send you. Go out and spend it, and that way the, you know, overall society will benefit and you'll benefit. And
right,
that people love that. What a painless thing that is to do. Oh, I have to go out and buy a new DVD player? Well, if the government tells me to, right, I guess I will.
Right. Again, it's bread and circuses. And ultimately, I think that's self-defeating as well.
Yeah, well, we aren't doing the thing which we need to do the most, which is to save,
exactly,
which is to take care of our own retirement
in the first place.
Yeah. So going back to the 50s and moving into the 50s and the early 60s,
right,
when does the Rand Corporation, what are some of the major movements in the Rand Corporation, and how does it affect, like, say, the Vietnam War, and then later on as we get into the evil?
That, let me tell
okay.
you. I mean, when Eisenhower gives his farewell speech, you know, and warns about the rise of the military-industrial complex, he's basically talking about people affiliated with RAND, because Eisenhower, being a general who had fought, obviously, in the Second World War, the commanding general, and being a guy from Kansas who detested hype, was convinced that there was no way we could win a nuclear war. At RAND, you have people who, from the very beginning of its, or the very, like, the fourth or fifth hire, was already saying, oh, we should preemptively attack the Soviet Union and destroy them before they get the bomb. This is before the Soviet Union, you know, set off its bomb. And then after we got the H-bomb, before they did it, they said the same thing. And these were people who kept harping on the fact that we have to build up our nuclear armaments and our nuclear defense. We have to build up. And after a while, Eisenhower said, no, we can't do that, because if there ever is a nuclear war, there won't be enough shovels to bury the dead. And, you know, he started trying to reach a compromise with the Soviet Union. But people within RAND, one of them is still alive, still in government, Andrew Marshall, by the way, who heads the Office of Net Affairs in the Pentagon right now, in charge of developing new weapons for the Pentagon. But maybe we'll talk about that later. They were totally opposed to that. And they said, no, we have to build up our defenses. We have to have more weapons, because there is such a thing as a missile gap. The Soviet Union has more missiles than we do. Of course, that turned out to be totally spurious. But this information was fed then to the Kennedy campaign, and that was one of the issues on which, you know, Kennedy was able to get to the White House, a so-called missile gap that never existed. Kennedy was a creature of the military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex, to a very large degree, was made up of people affiliated with RAND. So thus it begins. And then once Kennedy comes in, Then a lot of the people of land go over to the Pentagon, and they start reshaping the Pentagon. McNamara hired them in mass, because McNamara also believed in the numerical approach to society, to life. You know, I don't know if you recall the 5 o'clock follies in Saigon, where, they would go down the number of people dead and say, well, that will teach them that, they can't win this war. But, when you're dealing with people who are not following rational choice theory, that means nothing to them.
But wasn't McNamara, he was head of GM or Ford, wasn't he, at the time?
He was over at Ford. He reshaped Ford. He was by the time he was 40 years old, he had totally reshaped Ford. And, he used, a number of people that had been in the war with him, and they were called the Whiz Kids. And then when he went and hired all the RAND people to go over to the Pentagon, to reshape the Pentagon, to make it more responsive to the will of the president, they also were called the Whiz Kids. And they totally reshaped the Pentagon, and later the federal government.
All right. Well, I want to get into this, though, then, coming up in the next hour. The RAND Corporation vis-a-vis a couple of major events. Now, again, I just got the book on Thursday, so I'm kind of guessing here. But I want you to talk a little bit more about the RAND Corporation vis-a-vis the Vietnam War, sure. And I want you to talk more about the vis-a-vis the space race,
right.
and then the evil empire of the Reagan administration, and how, again, we're talking about the RAND Corporation, which feeds on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, and is a major player in a philosophy which I think we all sort of still feel today, but it all started with them. Soldiers of Reason, the RAND Corporation, and the Rise of the American Empire. We're an hour away from your phone calls, but you'll get a chance to join the conversation coming up, too, with Alex Abella on Coast to Coast AM with Ian Ponet. Alex Abella, Soldiers of Reason, all about the RAND Corporation. So we're just getting into the 60s. You were talking earlier about the TV series Ad Men, right?
Mad Men. Crazy.
Okay, but it's all about Ad Men, right?
That's
all about
absolutely, right. Yeah, right.
I haven't seen it yet. Oh, my wife was talking about it the other day.
Oh, it's a great show.
That's what everybody says. And it's sort of interesting. The rise of consumerism comes as a result of emphasis within the RAND Corporation and the sort of the political realization about the value of consumerism. So we see that rising. Now, where does the space thing come into it? That was the big movement of the 60s, along with, the anti-war movement. Was that anywhere part of the RAND Corporation philosophy?
The space race?
Yeah.
Well, RAND was involved in the space race by the development of spy satellites. Matter of fact, it's funny because I know that people on your show are very interested in Area 51 and stuff like that. And RAND was involved in certain experiments trying to, again, it was because of the conflict with the Soviet Union and trying to, spy on the Soviet Union. And they had released these balloons that floated to, very high with spy cameras on them. And it's believed that some of those may have given rise to the belief that, there were UFOs. But be that as it may, Iran is those attempts to spy on the Soviet Union with balloons with cameras attached to them were given up after some of those balloons crashed, landed in the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union protested, so the Eisenhower administration gave up on that. However, by the late 1950s, what they came up with was with the development of rockets, they came up with the idea of spy satellites. Basically, it would be taking some of the elements of those balloons. That is, it would be a rocket goes up into space and then it carries a camera and then takes pictures over the Soviet Union, and then it falls down to be picked up by an airplane. So it comes down in a parachute, and then the camera is picked up. That was called the Corona project, and that gave incredible amounts of information to the United States about the Soviet Union. I mean, the camera had such high resolution, they could even tell how much fruit was hanging from a tree. And this is, you know, from miles up in the sky. So it became even more important than the U-2 planes that, you know, had been also shut down by the Soviet Union that had caused an international crisis. So Rand was involved in that. Rand was also involved in the actual coming up with cost analysis for the development of the NASA program, but well, it was not directly involved in NASA itself.
Let me back up a little bit, though, because you mentioned before now, you know, a couple of things involving World War II and the Wernher von Braun and some of the other things. Was there ever any Nazi involvement in the Rand Corporation?
That's a very good question, and as far as I'm aware, there was not. There was no direct Nazi involvement in the Rand Corporation. In fact, some of the people who were some of the early associates of the Rand Corporation were refugees from the Nazis. There were a lot of the people were Jews, secular Jews, or you know, mostly secular Jews, and a lot of them had come, you know, were refugees from the Nazis. So I don't think there was a Nazi connection to them.
That's fine. I was just checking on that because I mean that we see that in you know obviously in the rocket program in the Air Force and other aspects. I just didn't know whether that had bled through, and I mean we think of. Or we used to think of as Wernher von Braun as being sort of a refugee of the Nazi rocket program. We know now a very different history for Wernher von Braun. But this wasn't a time though when there was still some very interesting global connections are being made where it seemed like there was just as you talk about the Rand Corporation playing on both sides of the political aisle, that there were many people within the United States that were playing on both sides of the war in World War II, and that they then after the war they were able to sort of reshape themselves as American, you know, good old Americans. But that for a while there, they may also have been sort of economically or militarily or technologically working with the enemies as well. So I didn't know whether any of that had bled into the Rand Corporation in terms of the playing both sides to the middle.
No, not as far as I'm aware as regards to Nazis. No, that's the one crime that I don't think you can attribute to them.
Okay, well, that's fine. Just checking. All right, so then we get into Vietnam War and Daniel Ellsberg. Now, how does Ellsberg come out of the Rand Corporation? But talking about the way you talk about it, doesn't seem like he fits.
Well, Ellsberg originally was the hawk. He was the golden boy of the Rand Corporation. He was a brilliant mathematician who was hired out of Harvard, and he had also been a Marine. He was like what he called himself was a Truman Democrat, you know, somebody who was a real hawk when it came to the Soviet Union, but a liberal when it came to social issues at home. And at first, he was all in favor of the Vietnam War. But after a couple of trips over there, he realized that, you know, the war wasn't what it was all cracked up to be. And then, in effect, we were like the redcoats over there, that is, we were an occupying force, and we were basically on the wrong side of the war. Then he started arguing against it, and he started trying to talk to McNamara and trying to get him to commit to start withdrawing troops or to not proceed with the war, but nobody would listen to him. So ultimately then, in order to show the world how we had gotten involved in this mess that was called Vietnam, he decided to bring out the Pentagon Papers, as you well know.
All right. No, but that brings me to something else, too, I've been curious about. And again, I haven't read yet all very far into the Soldiers of Reason about the Rand Corporation, but with every secret organization or semi-secret organization, there are consequences when one betrays one's oaths, right? And when we see that time and time again, whether it's Freemasons or, you know, the oaths that you take to be a member of an organization like the Knights Templar, if you did something that was considered to be disloyal by the group, there were often fatal retributions brought upon you. Can you talk about that in terms of the Rand Corporation? I mean, what happens when people blow the whistle on the Rand Corporation. Has there ever been anything like something like what Daniel Ellsberg went through, but with like physical danger involved?
Not since Dan Ellsberg. Nobody has dared to do that at the Rand Corporation. Matter of fact, the Rand Corporation, even though it afforded some kind of intellectual freewheeling environment in the 1950s and 60s, by the time that Dan Ellsberg sneaks out with the Pentagon Papers and has them published in the New York Times, after that, they really become buttoned down. And, you know, nowadays, they're just like, you know, they're just always on the message. They're just like any other large corporation that they want to make sure that, you know, nothing comes out of there unless they wanted to. That's why, in a way, I was surprised that, you know, they let me in. I approached them, and I thought, well, I don't think that they're going to say yes. But, you know, they did. They opened up their files, and they let me interview some of their old-timers, and they cooperated. After a while, they started, you know, how shall I put this? They were less than forthcoming, and I realized that, you know, I had to go on, regardless of what they said.
Had you crossed some sort of line with them where they were suddenly feeling like, uh-oh, this guy isn't going to write something nice about us?
Well, I believe I did. And, I mean, but basically, look, you know, I just tell it as I saw it. You know, I pulled no punches. And I just thought that this is a story that had to be told. But, you know, getting back to Ellsberg, like I said, you know, was a golden boy of Rand. And he was like the favorite of the president of the Rand Corporation at the time, Harry Rowan, who he called his best friend. And when he took the Pentagon Papers out and had them published, the president was forced to resign. And Ellsberg...
The president of Rand Corporation.
Rand Corporation, that's right.
Right.
And... And to this day, Ellsberg is persona non grata at the Rand Corporation. You know, he just can't go in there. They won't let him in. And of course, you know, he was prosecuted by the government. And as a result of that, and Nixon being so paranoid, they sent the plumbers, the infamous Richard Nixon White House plumbers, to to the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist, trying to look for information on him and to see what he had revealed. And when that came out, then that, you know, itself, that means that, you know, the charges against Ellsberg were dropped.
Sure.
And, you know, it's believed that perhaps even what happened at Watergate was a consequence of that. They were trying to find out exactly what it was that Ellsberg had told everybody, and they thought maybe they would have something over there at the Democratic headquarters.
Mm. So let's fast forward a little bit. After Nixon, then comes Carter, and then after Carter, well, we're getting forward in the middle, but then after Carter comes the rise of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Now, would you say this is like the apex of the Rand Corporation's political power, or is that yet to come?
No, I think that this was another peak. You know, there are peaks and valleys, and they had a peak under Reagan, just like they had a peak under Kennedy. They had a peak also under Bush as well, in the current administration, especially in the first term, when Paul Wolfowitz, who was, who had been at Rand, he was an intern at Rand, and who was a protege of the main intellectual heavyweight at Rand, Albert Wallstetter, was, the idea man behind the invasion of Iraq. So, and of course, Donald Rumsfeld went from being the chairman of the board of the Rand Corporation to being Secretary of Defense. So this is a direct link. Matter of fact, four years ago when Rumsfeld was here, and he was giving a speech, and he was surrounded by Jim Thompson, who was the president of Rand, and other people from Rand, and he looked, and Rumsfeld looked around and says, oh, this feels like, you know, a homecoming. I see all the people from Rand here. So there was a direct connection.
Mm. So under Reagan, though, this reshaping of the Soviet Union, talk about that a little bit.
Right. Okay. Well, in order to get that, you have to go back again to what I said to Wallstetter and the people associated with him, who decided that détente had to be killed. that you may recall that Ford and then Carter were trying to have a rapprochement with the Soviet Union.
Right. That was kind of embodied by Henry Kissinger was exactly, the poster child for detente, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Where these guys mounted a whole public relations campaign, and they even came up with something called Team B, which tried to use the same statistics and information that the CIA had in order to tell them that their analysis of the Soviet Union was wrong and the Soviet Union could not be trusted and they were really out to destroy the world still, et cetera, et cetera. And this, you know, they just harped on this for so many years, and they got Ronald Reagan to sign on it, on this. And ultimately, you know, when Reagan came into power, he brought to his administration a whole slew of people who had been with RAND, among them, or affiliated with RAND. He gave a medal to Wallstetter. He brought Wolfowitz in. Richard Pearl, who was, you know, an advisor, was also brought into the administration. It was another one of their peaks of power.
And so, but how does the RAND, I mean, so what then? It's a think tank. It's a particular worldview.
Yes.
So why, like, blow that up for a bigger picture. Why should we be feeling like that's sort of X-File-ish or that there's anything wrong with that? That's just another group of people, that there's another down, you know, three blocks further down in Washington, D.C., there's another think tank, and out of that group will come another group of people. And, I mean, what's different?
Because this is a democracy, because we're not supposed to have people who are deciding policy in the dark, I mean, who all of a sudden anoint themselves as the experts on things and say, well, this is the way it should be, because these are the people who got us into Vietnam. These are the people who got us into Iraq. These are the people who have turned us into an egotistical, egomaniacal consumer society, basically, it's not right.
Okay. Well, how did they get us into Iraq? How does the RAND Corporation get the United States into Iraq?
Good point. Okay. Here's how it goes. The RAND Corporation was, and a number of its people were involved in the PNAC, the Project for the New American Century. Your listeners may be familiar with that. They were advocating the getting rid of Saddam Hussein even before the first Operation Desert Storm. And after that, definitely, they were advocating that.
Now, why before the, what was Saddam doing before the first Desert Storm that made them want to do it?
Well, before the first Desert Storm?
Yeah. Why was Saddam?
The United States had to secure a source of energy in the Middle East.
Okay.
And that Iraq was the best place to go.
All right. So Saddam Hussein was targeted, according to the RAND Corporation, because he was the weakest link, or the one that was easiest to topple. And if you toppled that government and took it over, the other neighboring Arab nations wouldn't mind.
Well, that's ultimately the message that came out, even though I hasten to add, it isn't necessarily the RAND Corporation at this point, but it's the people who work or who were in the RAND Corporation who share the same point of view, and some of whom signed on to, you know, the Project for the New American Century, who were still at RAND, including Rumsfeld, of course.
Okay, fair enough.
They came up. They came out with this whole concept saying, you know, Iraq is the place, and you know, if we secularize these people, you know, we'll be able to transform the Middle East. And of course, it was Wallstetter who introduced Ahmed Chalabi to Washington, and you all remember who Ahmed Chalabi was. You know, he was the guy who was the embezzler who claimed to be the next George Washington of Iraq,
right,
and who fed false information about the supposed weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein had.
That we were all too willing to believe.
Oh, my God, were we ever.
Right, okay. So, all right, so let's just hang on to that thought for the moment. So what we have is, and I think this is very interesting, we have a corporation, the think tank group like the RAND Corporation, who inside and outside of their ranks are advocating for the toppling of Iraq. It was the easiest. It would have been the one that the other Arab nations would have complained least about, and it would have provided for us our own private oil well, essentially, in the Middle East. That's the premise. That's what we'll get back to Alex Abella coming up. The book is Soldiers of Reason, The Rand Corporation and the Rise of the American Empire. We'll talk for another half hour, and then we'll bring you into the conversation coming up at the top of the hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Alex Abella and the Soldiers of Reason, we're talking about the Rand Corporation, whose philosophy was essentially to accentuate consumerism. It took hold in the late 1950s, early 1960s in this country, and we've never looked back, where if you promote self-interest amongst the individual citizens, as opposed to kind of a collective patriotic view, if you push self-interest, then all sorts of things could happen. Governments can, if you'll pardon the expression, get away with almost anything. Now, we're talking about the pre-Iraq run-up of the first Persian Gulf War. And what evidence is there, Alex, that the Rand Corporation just decided, you know what, that we need to have a puppet Middle Eastern country where we can go in and get oil and we can always secure a supply of oil? What evidence is there that the Rand Corporation or the people that affiliated with it sought out Saddam Hussein and then effectively created a war out of it?
Well, we have the writings of the Wall Street Journal. We have articles, op-ed pieces there in the New York Times and a number of publications. We have reports as well that came out of Iran. We have, like I said, again, you know, think tanks, other like the Project for the New American Century as well. So all kinds of things that came out, and, you know, they were advocating intervention in the Middle East. I mean, that's...
Even before Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi army invaded Kuwait, you're saying they were preconditioning for an invasion in Iraq?
Well, they were laying down the groundwork. Particularly, I mean, it really took hold after he invaded Kuwait and he was not deposed. And that's when all the big cannons came out.
Let's talk about that. Because, the UN drew the line that says you can't just go in and get rid of Saddam Hussein. You could kick him out of Kuwait, but you can't go any higher than this parallel. And the U.S. government went along with it. Was that not part of the Rand Corporation or its affiliates' worldview?
No, it was not. Matter of fact, they felt that, you know, he should be deposed, that it was immoral to keep him there, which perhaps they had a point, but also that, you know, that as we were saying earlier, that we would be setting an example for the rest of the Middle East, that they would see that, you know, first of all, they couldn't act this way. Second of all, they would be able to set up a new kind of government, a secular government. Again, it's the folly of rational choice. It's assuming that everybody is rational the way we conceive of rationality. And that's what all these people, that they've all been drinking from the same Kool-Aid.
Right. So you're saying that, like, you're saying that about, like, say, Saudi Arabia or Syria, if in the end suddenly their economies improved, if their self-interest was satisfied, they wouldn't care that we invaded Iraq.
Exactly. Perfect. Okay. And besides, we'll be preserving, you know, advancing our own interests as well.
Right, which is always at the bottom line, the view of the Rand Corporation as you see it.
And all its people, right, to advance the cause of American interest, to advance the cause of the empire.
So is that why, are they the people at the core then of the low drumbeat that starts after Persian Gulf War I, where they start saying, we're going to have to go back. We got to get rid of Saddam. That's generated out of a Rand Corporation world.
That's right, out of Rand and Rand people. Specifically, like I said, Wallstetter, who, as I said, introduced Ahmed Chalabi to Washington, who became their man, who introduced them to Wolfowitz, and Wolfowitz then to everybody else. That's just how it went.
And where is this why Colin Powell is sort of always on the outs in the White House in those first years? I mean, is there like a Rand Corporation cobble at work in the White House, and then anybody who doesn't agree with it is just not allowed?
Good point. I never thought of that, but that might explain why Powell was on the outs. I mean, besides the fact that, you know, he was advocating much more a massive military presence. But of course, you know, again, You see, the RAND Corporation had issued a number of studies advocating what later came to be called the Revolution in Military Affairs. And the main instigator of that within the Pentagon was an old RAND alumni, as I mentioned earlier in the show, Andrew Marshall, who is the head of the Office of Net Affairs, which is coming up, whose job it is to come up with, you know, new weapons and, you know, discern new enemies on the horizon. That this revolution of military affairs is what Rumsfeld accomplished, and that's how come he was able to use such during the 2003 invasion of Iraq, with such a small, highly mobile invasion force that it went and punched all the way through, like an American blitzkrieg, all the way to Baghdad. And that was all part and parcel of the plans that have been drawn up by analysts within the RAND Corporation and by people who have been with the RAND Corporation who are affiliated with it. So it's all part and parcel of the same thing.
Hmm. The RAND Corporation, Soldiers of Reason, is the name of the book. We're talking with Alex Abeya, and we will get to your calls coming up at the beginning of next hour. I noticed certain things we say suddenly make the phones light up like crazy, so I'll be curious to see what happens when we start taking calls on the way. But all right, so then we get into Persian Gulf War II, and maybe so that is it. The RAND Corporation that's at the core of this connection that says, okay, here's our opportunity to invade Iraq. 9/11 happens, and as we know, Iraq has nothing to do with the folks who took down the World Trade Center. But we use that as we're going to go into Afghanistan, and then we're going to go into Iraq. And that's just part of the belief that somehow, all along, if we get into Iraq, we'll be okay because we'll have the oil. And we will make friends out of all of our new Middle Eastern neighbors. In the end, they'll be happy with the fact that we're there.
Because, after all, so the thinking goes, everybody wants to be like us.
Right.
That's the blind spot of rational choice. It assumes that everybody is rational the way that we define it, which, of course, people are not, especially in the Middle East, which has such a collectivist point of view.
Very interesting. So then,
and thinking of 9/11, don't forget terrorism studies. RAND originated terrorism studies.
They were the first to create the idea of a terrorist database.
That's right. It was RAND.
Why were they the first to do that? What was it about their philosophy, the rational choice philosophy, that led them to create a terrorist database?
Because I think they were trying to analyze something that was not rational. They were applying a rational framework to what they viewed as irrational things. So therefore, they tried to, how could something like this, they assumed that, let me.
No, I think that's very interesting. The idea that they were studying what they weren't.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
They were studying what they were not.
That's what they found out. Exactly, yeah. And they were trying to define an irrational force using rational tools.
Hmm.
And I think they were drawn to that because the whole purpose in life ever since 1946 has been to bring rationality, as they define it, to the world.
And really what it comes down to is that's why you have terrorists who are rich who become terrorists, and you have terrorists who are poor who become, but they all in all, they're still dedicated to this goal of bringing about a religious conversion of the world to their theological point of view.
Right.
Okay, and that just doesn't fit within the RAND Corporation model of what being a human is all about.
Not within rational choice. No.
Yeah.
Because it makes no sense.
Yeah, that's very. And so in a way, then, that may be why we didn't have an answer to terrorism for a while, that you almost have to have an irrational choice worldview in order to understand how to respond to terrorism.
Or you have to allow for that, for the fact
yeah.
that people are like this. I mean, obviously, we try to be rational, but rationality is just a tool. Humans, from my perspective, are basically irrational creatures, and we rationalize things to justify our desires. But rationality is a tool, is not the essence of humanity. And that's what doesn't get through in rational choice theory.
See, and I would argue something, and your point of view is taken. I would say that I think we are basically rational creatures who are self-interested, but we have, like everything else, we hold in tension with that a kind of incoherence. where we have to do things that are chaotic periodically because it helps us understand our rationality. So that's why you have perfectly reasonable people who, you know, spend their day happily going on, you know, going to a job that they reasonably like and having a family, and they go on a drinking binge. And then it's just sort of, or they go to, why Mardi Gras is tied into Lent. And I think there's things like that we just have that just puts totally chaotic things in tension with the perfectly orderly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just a theory I've had for a long time, but I'm not getting any funding from anybody. So that's where the theory will end. So, all right. So now what about Iran? What do you see in the saber rattling about Iran that comes from the RAND Corporation?
Well, I think Iran is very different from the jihadist movement, because I think Iranians are basically rational. Which is funny because they're religious leaders, but they're
right.
Very rational. They're rational actors. They're acting as such. So in a way, they're almost like the Soviet Union. So I think you can reason with them, and I think that will apply there.
Okay, but if it doesn't seem like we're heading down a road to reason with Iran.
Oh, I think this is all saber rattling. I don't think we're really going to do anything over there. I don't think that at least this administration, and I hope the next one, will not risk losing, just sending the world into an incredible recession, if not a depression, over something that may or may not happen. And I think it's pretty well proven that these guys are not really developing these weapons, these atomic weapons. I mean, we think they are, but if they do, it will be years and years from now.
Right.
I don't see this administration doing something about it. I think they're going to try to scare them.
Right.
It's, again, appealing to the rational instincts. But I don't know if you're aware of this, but, you know, there's been a lot of low-level contact between the two. I just don't see anything happening like that. Even though,
now, what if,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, well, what about President Clinton's administration? Where was the RAND Corporation influence during that?
You know, that was one of those periods during which they lay low.
The RAND Corporation. Did.
Yes, that's right. The RAND Corporation. I mean, obviously, we're still getting contracts from the Pentagon. It was still developing, you know, its social science work, which, by the way, is excellent. They've done fantastic work when it comes to the health field, when it comes to trying to, you know, in other areas as well. Even the rational choice, by the way, has extended to criminal justice, which I think is totally insane. But be that as it may, they've done a lot of work in other fields, and the Clinton administration was one of those periods in which they tried to lay low. The one thing that they did do, and they advocated all the time, is that they wanted a NATO to be expanded all the way to Eastern Europe, and they were pushing for that all the time during the Clinton administration. And the other thing that they did as well is that a lot of their RAND actors, so to speak, they got involved again in the PNAC, and they got the Iraq Liberation Act drafted and approved by the Congress and signed by the President. As you know, that's the act that said that, you know, we were in favor of deposing Saddam Hussein, but the law, had no teeth because there were no provisions for actually going in there and getting rid of the guy.
You know, you mentioned Barack Obama quoting the RAND Corporation not long ago in the campaign trail. What about John McCain? Has he talked about RAND at all, or do you see a Randian influence in the McCain camp?
Well, I obviously, you know, being a military man and being a former, you know, pilot, even though he was for the Navy, there's a lot of influence in there. And like I said, I mean, these guys are perfectly positioned to be whoever comes in.
Okay. So you think that the RAND Corporation is back to playing both sides of the aisle again?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
And that's what they will do. They're part of the permanent government.
They're part of the permanent government, the non-elected part of the government.
That's right, exactly. They elected themselves. They're self-appointed.
And they get, you said they get 50% of their funding from the government?
That's right, from the federal government.
How much do they getting a year at the RAND Corporation?
You know,
any idea?
I don't have the exact figures, but it's hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions of dollars to think.
Uh-huh.
To think.
Yes.
What do they do with that money? I mean, they think those are very expensive donuts. I mean,
Well, they have a very nice building in Santa Monica, and they have offices in Qatar. They have offices in Switzerland. They have offices in other parts of the world, and, you know, they employ over 1,000 people, and they all get paid fairly well. And they have one of the largest graduate schools in policy.
Which one's that? What's
the Pardee School of Policy. It's cited that it's at the Rand, in the Rand building itself.
Okay.
So, that's
interesting. I have a friend who's into public policy, and she spoke about the Rand Corporation all through her master's thesis work. She kept talking about the Rand Corporation, what interesting work they were doing and how they're this great organization. And I would say she was politically on the left. And so that always surprised me, because when I would see Rand Corporation associated with people on the right, I thought maybe there's a Rand McNally Corporation. maybe I didn't have the right group, but now I understand it's all part of the same mill.
Yep.
So then people can go study and get a master's degree in public policy from the Rand Corporation.
That is correct.
Okay. And do you have to agree with their philosophies in order to study there?
Well, I don't know. Do you have to agree with the philosophy of Harvard to study there?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know whether I can't imagine, but
here's the thing. It's not that it's a doctrine. It isn't that you have to sign off on the doctrine when you join. But however, if you're not of that particular mind frame,
right.
You probably won't get accepted, and B, if you do get accepted, you won't be too happy there.
Right.
If you don't believe that people are rational, if you don't believe that you have to, you know, people are self-interested actors, if you don't believe in secularism, if you don't believe in all these different things, you know, even though they might not tell you that's what they believe in, but obviously it informs all of their decisions. If you don't believe in that, you know, either you won't get in, or you get in, you'll want to drop out.
How about foreign leaders? Do we know how many leaders, the presidents or, you know, princes of other countries have come through the Rand Corporation?
I don't think leaders have gone through there, but their advisors certainly have.
Okay. I'm curious about that, because there's always that type of connection that's often made between our leaders and, you know, when you actually study it, you find out they played on the same rugby team somewhere, and it's, right? Somebody somewhere in another country.
Right.
Well, the Soldiers of Reason, well, I love the way we're starting. I have no idea on how this is going to end coming up. The Rand Corporation and the American Empire. Is this where we are right now today? Is this what the founding fathers of the Soldiers of Reason, of the Rand Corporation, is this what they had in mind?
Not at all. I don't believe this is what they had in mind at all. First of all, they all, you know, going from, I believe in what George Washington said, you know, to try to stay away from foreign entanglements. Also, I believe in a democracy.
You missed me. No, I mean, did the founding fathers of the Rand Corporation, do those founding fathers, do they look at this and say, yep, this is what we were hoping for?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you think so?
Exactly what they were hoping for.
Okay, very good. No, I had a feeling George Washington wouldn't be on board. But
no.
All right, and then I want to get back to that one thing that I said we would park. So in the next hour, can we get back to what were we talking about before? Remember, Alex and I said I want to talk about that later.
You wanted to talk about the empire, the space race in Vietnam?
No. There was one more thing, and I said you said you get into that all the time, and I said I do too. Darn it, what was that? I'll think of it.
Revolution of Military Affairs?
No, that wasn't it either. There was one more thing. You mentioned it, and I said, don't hang on to that. We'll get back to that. I can't remember what it is, but I know it'll occur to me coming up in just a second. But where are you going to take us with Alex Abella, Soldiers of Reason? You jump into the conversation next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I got a couple of wildcard lines open if you want to get in on this. It's been very interesting. It's the Soldiers of Reason, the Rand Corporation, and the Rise of the American Empire. Alex Abella is the author, and we're talking about the Rand Corporation's influence, this think tank that crosses over every, you know, political group and to various aspects of our government, including getting us in and out of wars. Well, mostly into wars, I should probably say. And Alex, while I've got you here and while we're lining up the callers,
Right.
Let me just go back to that thing. That was the toll roads. That's what I was thinking.
That's right.
Now, well, you brought up toll roads earlier. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mentioned toll roads because there was a guy who was a consultant at RAND. His name was William Vickrey, and he won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1996, and he provided the rationale for the theory of road pricing. That is that if you charge motorists tolls and fees for the use of roads, that will show consumers what the true costs of the road upkeep are. And therefore, you know, it will either lessen traffic congestion or will provide governments, you know, with a nice source of income. So even toll roads.
Right. Very well. See, and I look at toll roads, I think of toll roads sort of metaphorically. And I always remember that toll roads is one of those things where they tell you one thing up front. And this is almost true every time with a toll road. Well, we'll have a toll road for the next 5 or 6 years in order to get this built, and then it'll pay for itself.
And then it never stops, right.
And it never stops.
No, that's right.
I think that's such an interesting metaphor for how government works.
That's right.
Just tell whatever you want. People think, well, great, it'll be a road, it'll be free, and in 5 or 6 years, and we'll have this beautiful highway that we can always ride for free.
Mm-hmm.
And then people buy into it, and it's never true, or rarely do they yank out the toll booths anyway.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. They just find another way to keep using the money. We'll get back to this then. Well, that's it for me on this. But where are you going to go with Alex Abella, Soldiers of Reason, the RAND Corporation, and the Rise of the American Empire next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I just love this. So many people have been waiting 15, 20 minutes already to get through to Alex Abella. Let's start west of the Rockies, where Scott is in California on Coast to Coast AM for the Soldiers of Reason. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, good evening, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Couldn't be better. Thank you.
Fine.
And Ian, I just want to make a quick comment. 5-6 weeks ago when you interviewed, was it Steve Quayle or something, you apologized for being too tough on him? Was it him? Or?
Yes, it was a little longer than 5 or 6 weeks ago, but
yeah,
yes.
But you were not too tough on him. He's been screaming, sky is falling, for 8-10 years like that, and nobody's ever challenged him. I was glad you challenged him. And you apologized, which I thought was unnecessary, but you did the right thing to actually ask him some questions about. He's been saying this stuff for years. I've been listening to it, and I used to take it to heart, and I don't anymore. I think he's just a big phony now. And if he ever has anything right, it's because of luck. But now back to Alex.
Well, let me just say real quickly on that. He made some predictions for August. I made a note on a Post-it note. I stuck it right here next to my computer. So we'll know more here in about 30 days. But go ahead. You had a question.
Yeah. I'm not counting months or whatever.
That's
but
that's fine.
He's been screaming, sky is falling for years.
Go ahead. Alex Abella
anyway,
is here for you.
For Alex. First
yes,
of all, for the Iraq war, okay, there's been 17, or what was it? Bush had like 17 resolutions through the UN, and Saddam was not cooperating with the UN and the inspectors and all that. He kicked them all out. Obviously, we remember that. So how can that be just something from the RAND Corporation? Now, the RAND Corporation, from the point of view that they're a liberal group, I do detest them. But I would also say that people in this country are so uninformed and so self-serving that you do need groups like the Bilderbergs and the RAND Corporation or somebody else to set policy for long-term goals that the average public is just not smart enough anymore and not capable of making the decisions. They shouldn't even be allowed to vote. And I'm glad that those groups are out there controlling things. They vote for things like nationalized health care or whatever. They're just all greedy. They want something from the government, and that's all they care about. They don't care about anything policy. They don't even know about anything policy.
All right, well,
and it's probably because it's brought up from school. But
well, let's give Alex a chance to respond to that, though, okay? I mean, I think
yeah, – okay,
go ahead.
Sure, go ahead.
Go ahead. Alex?
Well, you know, with all due respect, sir, I mean, I believe in a democracy. I think that this is a government of the people, for the people, and by the people. And I think that it's the people who should make those decisions, and not just small groups of self-anointed experts who decide what's supposedly best for the nation at large. So I disagree with you. And if there are policy questions that have to be decided, I think voters should decide on that. That's where we're a democracy, and we're not a totalitarian state.
Okay. Well, and interesting opinion. Thank you, Scott. But let's get to Mike in Davenport, Iowa, on Coast to Coast AM for Alex Abella. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Alex, and hi, Ian.
Hi.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, I would like to know what Alex and you would think about the Council on Foreign Relations have on the last 80 years on the effect of the State Department and the...
You're getting distracted by that radio in the background, and I totally understand that. Let's talk about that. The CFR, that is one of those groups that a lot of people associate with being a kind of a super secret organization. But they have some cross-pollinization with the RAND Corporation, don't they?
Yes, they do. Matter of fact, you know, a number of people belong to that. But it's not that the Council of Foreign Relations doesn't have the kind of theoretical background, I think, that the RAND Corporation has come up with. And it certainly doesn't have the, you know, the number of Nobel Prize winner winning economists and theorists or the people. I don't think they've been as influential as the RAND Corporation, but there is a lot of, you know, contacts between the two organizations. It's sort of like other groups that the RAND Corporation and people who are within RAND belong to. So there's, like you say, a lot of cross-pollinization, but there's no direct link between the two.
What do you think is, I mean, Council on Foreign Relations comes up a lot as being an organization that has an invisible hand and a secret agenda, and they're trying to unite, you know, all of North America under one currency and other things like that. Where do you rank them next to the RAND Corporation in terms of impact in our economic or social views?
I don't see them as having that great an influence. I mean, to me, they're not. I just don't see them as having the same kind of impact that the RAND Corporation has had.
Okay, Todd in Dayton, Ohio, on Coast to Coast AM. East of the Rockies for Alex Abella. Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, hey, guys. You were talking about Daniel Ellsberg just a little while ago.
Yes.
Mr. Ellsberg was on Coast to Coast with George about 2 weeks ago.
Right.
I didn't know if you – well, Ian, you probably did know that. But
yep.
I personally think Ellsberg is a rat. I think he probably had an idea to – he was sent out on a mission to release those papers to prolong the war. Probably a lot of people that I know in conjunction to keep the Federal Reserve loaded with money. They make money off wars, as we know.
But stop for a second. I mean, what? Tell me, why would you come to that conclusion based on what he said on Coast to Coast?
Well, it wasn't just that discussion that he had on Coast to Coast, but it's looking back on what he did in disclosing strategies and plans of the United States government that the North Vietnamese obviously got a hold of and used as, you know, things that they could take advantage of us for, and it kept the war prolonged and cost United States servicemen lives. So I believe Ellsberg should be in jail or should have been in jail. He's a lucky fella that he's not.
All right.
But
well, your thought – Wait, hold on. Todd, you said a lot there. Go ahead, Alex.
Ellsberg's purpose in taking out the Pentagon Papers was to try to stop the war, to bring it to a halt. And again, it goes back to what I've been saying time and again, that, you know, this is a democracy, and you just can't have all these secret papers, I mean, you know, all these secret decisions made in closed rooms that affect all of us. And basically what Ellsberg was trying to show, what Dan was trying to show, is that we have been lied to for years and years and years, and he was trying to get the American people to come to their senses and to say, stop this war. This war is wrong. And thus, had it been stopped, we would have been able to save more soldiers' lives.
What's wrong with that theory?
It's guys like Seymour Hersh also that are out. They're releasing propaganda in regards to this Iranian situation for the past 3 or 4 years. Seymour Hersh or The New Yorker has been putting out information that we're already in Iran. We've got operatives there. These people are – I see them as treasonous. They're putting lives in danger if we in fact have – operatives over there. We don't want these folks in Iran to know this, but these.
All right. Well, hang on a second. Here's a philosophical disagreement, and help me with this. If you look back historically, our government never admitted to being in places where it was, and in fact called people liars and said, "We'll just use Cambodia during the Vietnam War. We are not in Cambodia. It's not happening." Well, we were up to our waist in Cambodia already, but it was in the political self-interest to say, oh, no, we're not. Or even if you could even make the argument in the military self-interest to call people liars and say it's not happening, when in fact they were right. So I'm not so sure just because the government says we're not in Iran that we aren't in Iran. Now, a larger question is, don't you want a free society where the government is kept on its toes as opposed to just being able to do what it wants and telling us, no, this is the best thing, that you only need to know what you need to know, where the government take our word for it? I mean,
I believe the people should be very careful that there's not ulterior motives behind some of these individuals that are out here acting as champions for the United States citizen, when in fact they may very well be acting in another manner that's very dangerous to this country. The one question I wanted to get through to you, Alex, though.
Yes, sir.
If I can just answer this. You mentioned Wolfowitz, Paul Wolfowitz.
Yes, sir.
Douglas Feith, and there was another fellow, Feith, Wolfowitz, and Pearl, that you mentioned Pearl as well.
I mentioned Pearl and Wolfowitz, not Feith. Feith did not have any direct relationship to Rand.
Well, okay, I know not for Rand, but there was a group created at the beginning of Bush's administration, Office of Special Policy.
Mm-hmm.
Those three were the primary components of that particular group. And there's a common thread between all these people that we talk about. They're all Jewish. And that begins to concern me because they start looking out for Israel, and the United States then becomes a surrogate for protection of Israel. And that really worries me when these guys.
Well, wait, hold on a second. Stop for a second. I mean, there's. I realize you don't think of that as anti-Semitic. I understand you don't. But okay, I know you don't. I could just tell that you wouldn't think of it that way. I don't think you have any proof, though, that these guys are looking out for Israel. Just because they were born Jewish or we are cultural Jews, I don't see any. I mean, do you see anything in there directly tying them all into Israel? It seems like a lot of evangelical Christians are some of the most pro-Israel people.
Absolutely.
In the United States, and that too is part of the Bush administration. But you
and
can comment on
Bush is not Jewish,
and he's very pro-Israel.
That's right.
Okay, let me get to David in Hawaii on Coast to Coast AM. David.
Yes.
Hi, you're talking with Alex Abeya, Soldiers of Reason. Go ahead.
Ian, Alex, thank you for taking my phone call.
Aloha.
First, I just wanted to make a comment, if that's all right. Ian, the show you did with the interview with Jesus, I thought that was fantastic.
Glad you liked it.
Bravo. That was great.
And, thank you. I'm taking a lot of heat for that show, but I really enjoyed it, too.
I noticed.
That was really interesting.
I've noticed that, yeah.
But go ahead. You had a thought for Alex?
Yes. Yes, I do. I just want to say, as Joe Blow, average American, my life is really just stressed out with how am I going to pay my gas cost each month? How am I going to pay my food cost each month?
Right.
I'm stuck worrying about day-to-day and week-to-week troubles. Can you tell me, is this Rand Corporation, you know, do they really propose a personal threat to me, to the average American? Or is this something that I have to continue to put on the back burner because your previous caller made a comment about the average American being stupid?
Okay.
It's not that we're stupid. It's just that we have so many other worries on our mind. You know?
Oh, I totally agree. But on the other hand, I think that part of the problems that you're having can be derived directly from thinking and doctrine that came out of the Rand Corporation. I mean, when you're talking about the financial problems that we're having right now, especially when it comes to the housing market, which is if you're referring to that, deregulation of the financial industry and the high price of oil and the intervention in Iraq, I mean, all these things are related to that. that. Now, obviously, the RAND Corporation doesn't have, you don't have the goons of the RAND Corporation out there with a gun coming, you know, knocking at your door saying, you know, show me what you got. However, what you, as a voting citizen, you have to realize these are people who are changing our life, and that you have to know what they've done, and you have to identify who it is who is following their line, and you have to decide what it is that you want to do about it. Because after all, as I say in my book, Soldiers of Reason, at the end, you know, the RAND Corporation is every one of us. Because as long as we allow these people to do what they're doing, they're going to keep doing it, and it's up to us. This right. government is ours, and we have to take it back if we don't like it.
Let's get to Douglas, San Francisco, on Coast to Coast AM. He's on a wildcard line for Alex Abella, Soldiers of Reason. It's all about the RAND Corporation. Douglas?
Yeah, hi. I wanted to congratulate both of you, especially you, Mr. Pundit, on your coronation.
Coronation.
You, the Deke.
Yes. Okay, I'll be
I hope Alex Abella, whose book I'm going to rush out to buy, and you yourself can have a show discussing theology someday.
That sounds interesting. But yeah. Go ahead. Now, where are you with this?
Well, 5 years before I was born, in 1961, the Joint Chiefs of Staff established the Joint War Games Group, which was a RAND-MIT consortium that okay. served as a Pentagon-level gaming agency. And they were gaming all these thermonuclear war scenarios at a time when the Soviet Union only possessed 4 operational ICBMs.
Correct.
So there's definitely this ideology behind them of over-exaggeration. When I was in Iraq in 1988, I found out why the Bush administration was so easily swayed by their arguments, was because Bush was this fossilized cold warrior, and Saddam Hussein was a great admirer of Joseph Stalin, whose
right.
statues I saw all over the place, and he went on pilgrimages to Stalin's birthplace and his death site, etc. And they were training in Soviet battle doctrine at the time with some Russian advisors. They were armed with AK-47s as opposed to the Iranians, who had German Heckler and Koshes. And most of all, what was decisive was that the Mujahideen al-Khalqa, which was an Iranian liberation group, had an extremely Marxian ideological orientation. They were almost all female, because these were all female PhDs, MDs, DDSs, CPAs, and attorneys at law who were not allowed to practice in Iran. So this was all-female combat slots, and this was the highest educated army ever to hit the field in the history of mankind, and that's where the domino effect theory was pushed on George Bush Sr. They said, oh, not only is Saddam Hussein this potential Soviet satellite, but he's about to send all these liberated Iranian overeducated women back to do a regime change and kick these mentally retarded clerics out. And at the time I was there, they covered up anything that would make Iraq look good and the Iranians look bad. One of them was the first use of a 747 as a missile. And that was the USS Vincennes incident. And while I was in Iraq working for the propaganda ministry of Saddam Hussein, the Iranians lost a war, a naval battle with the United States. It was called Operation Praying Mantis. And this was about April 14th or afterwards. And the Americans sank 3 Iranian warships and destroyed 6 suicide speedboats. But they never told anyone at home. And the Iranians responded by sending out the 747, and it wouldn't veer from its course, so the captain of Vincennes was forced to shoot it down. And all the footage we saw back in Iraq showed that there were hundreds of naked men in the water with their hands tied behind their backs. So we knew they were all Iraqi prisoners of war. So,
all right, well, hang on a second. That's all we got time for, going to the break, but we'll give Alex Abella a chance to respond to that. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, we were listening to Douglas from San Francisco just before the bottom of the hour, and Alex hadn't had a chance to respond to it yet. But you heard Douglas talking about his experiences in Iraq and the Vincennes having to shoot down that 747 that was filled with prisoners from his own experience. Alex, did you take some notes there? Did some things you wanted to respond to in that?
No, it's just that that what I wanted to respond to dealt directly with RAND was the whole question of the war games and the missile gap, which, you know, it's, he was referring to the whole question of the United States supposedly, you know, being behind the Soviet Union when it came to the development and nuclear missiles, and actually missile gap, if it actually existed, just being for the United States, because, you know, the Soviet Union only had, like the gentleman said, 4 operating missiles at the time. So, yes, it's the kind of thing that RAND has been involved in.
It has the ring of truth for a RAND operation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Wild card line, Bert is in California on Coast to Coast AM. for Soldiers of Reason, the RAND Corporation, and the Rise of the American Empire. You're talking with Alex Abeya. Go ahead, Bert.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to mention that McCasey, the U.S. Attorney General, has not yet appointed a special prosecutor into the rape of a federal agent. My wife was raped by a federal agent, and or the Bay Area Filipina suicides and rapes.
Yeah, you talked about this before, Bert, but how does that come into the RAND Corporation here?
Oh, well, I just wanted to do, I called the wild card line, so I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, but it's not open line night. I mean, I appreciate that, but it doesn't. I hope that you don't just keep doing that just to keep making that point. And I did look up what you said about the internet, and it seemed like there were some other stories that were written about that in the newspaper too. So anyway, let's just confine this if we can to Soldiers of Reason, the RAND Corporation. Eddie has a question for Alex Abeya in Naples, Florida. Go ahead, Eddie.
Hey, Ian, I just want to let you know it's a pleasure to talk with you. I listen to you guys all the time.
Thank you.
Anyway, what I want to say is...
Eddie, what happened to you? Eddie, where'd you go?
He had too much to say.
He exploded from pure joy of being chosen on Wild Card Line 3.
That's too bad.
Eddie, did you drop? Eddie, did your cell phone go out? You weren't on hold that long. Richard is in Bakersfield, California on Coast to Coast AM for Alex Abeya. Go ahead, Richard.
Well, thank you. And approximately 45 years ago, I remember reading the book on thermonuclear war by Herman Kahn.
Absolutely.
He was a RAND think tank member, and the essence of the book, as I remember it, is that in the event of full-scale nuclear war, we would survive as a human race, and all I ask for is comment on that, and I thank you for this show.
No problem. I have the book right in front of me as we speak, because I'm speaking from my office, and yes, Herman Kahn was with the RAND Corporation at the time. Matter of fact, the funny thing is that when he gave these talks all around the country, based on his book, the RAND Corporation people were really against it because they thought that he was popularizing their doctrine of counterforce, which is what they called it. They weren't too happy, and he was forced to resign from RAND. But yeah, Herman Kahn, who was a physicist and who became the most prominent spokesman for the RAND Corporation, was not necessarily a believer, but he did think that nuclear wars were winnable and that the way to win them was by having a massive system of civil defense wherein people would actually take refuge in caves and tunnels when the war happened. And afterwards, you know, they would come up to the surface and, you know, there were some genetic mutations because of radiation. Well, you know, we could live with that because, you know, in nature there's always genetic mutations. But he did say that the nuclear war was winnable. And, you know, some people were horrified by that, and some people called it, you know, pornography as well. So he became very controversial. And then later on, he founded his own institute, his own think tank called the Hudson Institute, and he specialized in futurology, you know, and trying to anticipate what the future would be like.
I had a neighbor who had a bomb shelter.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, you know, one of those popular things was considered pretty chic to have, like a backyard pool or something.
That's right. It was right around that time. That's when they built a whole bunch of them. Yeah.
And there were all these folks who were traveling around, and they were talking about the winnableness of the war and how if you just survived that part, you could come out of it.
Right.
And if you had enough cans and had enough water, that if we had been hit by a series of nuclear weapons, you know, there'd be rebuilding, and you know, there'd be some reseeding, you'd have to be some replanting, but you could basically start life over again.
I know. At that time, nobody had thought of nuclear winter. I mean, that's something that concept came up 20 years later.
Yeah. Catherine is in Central Coast, California on Coast to Coast AM. Catherine?
Hi, Ian. This is a great show.
Thank you.
You know, maybe the topic that you were trying to think of that you were going to get back to was about the Nazis.
Oh, it was about the tollways. Is what it was.
Oh, okay.
But because he did address the Nazis and the fact that it's almost surprisingly nobody in the RAND Corporation had any Nazi ties. And I say that surprisingly because so many people in our government and especially the State Department had come from that old boys' school where there had been some, you know, playing on both sides of the fence to the run-up of the war. So I just thought there might have been, but there wasn't.
No, no. The thing is that there were so many Jews in the RAND Corporation right from the beginning that I think that just would not have.
Counter to that. Well, my question for your guest, Ian, is these terms that have come up in this current administration for the new forms that they're introducing into government, like Homeland Security and Patriot Act, do any of these things come out of RAND Corporation concepts?
Oh, that's a great question.
What was the question again? I'm sorry.
About do any of these new concepts, Homeland Security, all of the approaches to terrorism, is that driven by anything particular from the RAND Corporation?
Well, I think that's based on a lot of studies that the RAND Corporation has done for the government. So the answer is yes.
And this concept of these false senses, these false security blankets that we have, you know, that started. And I wonder where that had come from, this belief, like, you know, taking shoes off, getting onto planes, and other things that seem to be driven out of a philosophy of it doesn't make any sense to us, I think, to most people going in, that they were confiscating tweezers. I mean, that some of these seem like some philosophical paper somewhere was written that said, people love this stuff, do more of it.
I don't think you can blame RAND for government inefficiency. I mean,
but think of that philosophy.
As always.
Yeah, but think of that philosophy that says that if people feel like they're in control or they feel like something's happening, it doesn't matter whether or not it really is. Right? I mean, like when they're confiscating silicone out of bras and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, this is just way out of control.
Or when they stopped the 85-year-old white lady grandmother, you know, thinking that she might be a terrorist, you know.
Right, and giving her a full cavity search.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. They just see that always that seems consistent with something, and if it's not RAND Corporation, I don't know what it is. All right, so Jay in Florida on Coast to Coast AM for Soldiers of Reason, Alex Abella. Go ahead, Jay.
Hey, Alex, I want to thank you so much for writing this book. You know, a lot, I mean, this information needs to get out. There's
thank
just
you.
So much stuff happening in our country right now, and we're at a real juncture, I think. I think a lot of people are waking up to the fact that the Federal Reserve is a private central bank,
right,
and that RAND Corporation and other things are just taking over.
Right. And I think that we are in a very momentous time, because I think that now with the new administration, especially if Mr. Obama, Senator Obama comes in, I think that we could have a slight reversal of some of the things that have occurred over the last, since 1980, especially when it comes to the implementation of rational choice in the financial world and the financial aspect of life. On the other hand, you know, I think the RAND Corporation is preparing itself for that as well. I mean, obviously, they've already prepared themselves for the withdrawal from Iraq. I mean, 2 years ago, the guy who was the ambassador to Afghanistan, James Dobbins, who is now with RAND, I wrote a book advocating the immediate withdrawal of all American forces from Iraq, saying that this is a problem that the Iraqis themselves have to decide, and we're just exacerbating the problem by our presence there. So once again, you know, they're part of the permanent government, but you can't solve all the problems and all these ills all in one stroke. You have to go step by step. So I think that this election this year, I think, will be really momentous, because we could begin to reverse some of the ill, toxic effects of rational choice theory.
Yeah, I mean, number one, it's the monetary system. I mean, all these people,
right.
I'm sorry, but everybody's talking about, you know, Hillary and everybody, they're talking about health care, they're talking about all this. Are we stupid? We can't do this. We can do it, say, in 8 years if, number one, we get the monetary system figured out. I mean, there was so much great energy in this campaign with people like Ron Paul, who has, you know, people can call him crazy and stuff for a lot of his ideas, but his economics are solid.
Right. No, I would agree with that. I think he's got a strong view, very consistent view that seems not just based on what was going to get him elected, obviously,
right, exactly.
Because it didn't get him elected.
I mean, I don't agree with everything he says, but I do recognize him as a man of principle, and I respect him for that.
And consistency. First-time caller line, Bob is in Indiana on Coast to Coast AM for Alex Abella. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
Ian, you and George and the people that have replaced have just done such a wonderful job I had to say that before.
Thank you. It's a high bar, but we work on it every day, so thank you.
It is. It was a high bar that I never thought could be beat, and you guys have really pleased me. It's it took a while for me to get used to it, and my expectations weren't real high, but I really enjoy Coast to Coast just like I used to enjoy Art Bell.
Thank you. I think actually I was trying to figure it out. I think I'm coming up on my 10th anniversary on Coast to Coast.
Well, I didn't hear you. For whatever reason, I don't remember you that much when Art regular. I don't know why that is. But anyway.
I was inexperienced. So go ahead. Here's your question for Alex Abella.
Well, I don't know if it's a question, but he has said several times, and I agree with him on many of the points he's making, but one thing I strongly disagree with, based on history, and is this country was not formed to be a democracy. It was formed to be a democratic constitutional republic. And if the people want to do something that was not originally etched into the Constitution, the people themselves are barred from doing it unless they see to it that the Constitution gets changed. For example,
I do respect, sir. I disagree. The Constitution says that all those things that are not specifically outlawed and mentioned, that those rights are still reserved by the people. So
All right. So, but your application of that's true. That's in the Bill of Rights.
Yes.
But your application of it is that the people, I think. If I heard it right, you guys got off on the national health care or something?
A caller did.
What's that?
A caller did.
Okay,
go
right,
ahead.
Right. A caller did, the federal constitution does not empower the federal government to take on that responsibility. Now, it does empower it does reserve for the states to do that if they want to do that. But the original document that formed our federal government did not give Congress or the president, federal government, the authority to do that. So if the people, because of their ignorance, their lack of education, their emotion, whatever their reason, if they want the federal government to do that, the only way it can be legitimately done, and there's a million examples like this that's already been being done. In fact, the precedent that it's being done by on now is the Constitution has to be amended in order for the people to get the federal government into the business of national health care.
All right, then hang on, Bob. Go ahead and response then from Alex.
Well, I don't
a little outside your area. Yeah, it's not quite your area, but you write a lot of columns, so maybe this has come up along the way.
Yeah, no, it hasn't come up, but I beg to differ. I mean, I don't think that you need a constitutional amendment in order to have national health care. I mean, and besides which, you know, the Constitution is a very flexible instrument. It just depends on what your interpretation of it is. And I frankly don't see anything in the Constitution or in the Bill of Rights that outlaws the government from instituting national health system. I mean, after all, we already have Medicare. We already have a Social Security system. And I don't see what the problem is unless you're going under its restraint of trade or something like that. But otherwise, I just don't see it. But then that's my opinion, and of course it has nothing to do with the Rand Corporation.
Let's get to Mike in Arizona on Coast to Coast AM. We'll get to as many people as we can, although time is running out, and the lines are full for Alex Abella. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, Ian, I want to give you the name for the guy you should have as a follow-up to this show. It's Thomas E. Ricks, and he wrote Fiasco. And my question is, was the U.S. military's failure to capture bin Laden in Tora Bora a plot in order to let him off the hook so that we could make the attack in Iraq and the capture of Saddam more of a viable, believable thing?
That's an interesting thought, that somehow if we had successfully got Saddam Hussein, there would have been no reason. Sorry, if we had successfully gotten Osama bin Laden, we would have felt like mission accomplished. And because we didn't, there was more of an inspiration to go into Iraq.
Well, that's a great thought. I wouldn't put it past them, but again, I wouldn't know. I don't know firsthand, but I guess, like I said, judging by what's happened in the past, that would not surprise me.
Kevin is in St. Paul, not far from me, I imagine, on Coast to Coast AM. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hey guys, nice to talk to you.
And you too.
I'll try to keep this brief and on point here because it's a great conversation. I think that the focus of this is really what is freedom, and freedom to me is two things. It's the rights that we all love to talk about and love to have, and are entirely driven by our own self-interest and self-indulgence in a sense. And the other half of freedom that nobody ever talks about, or nobody wants to talk about, certainly not politicians, is the responsibility that goes with it as well. And the problem that we have now, and the thing that opens the door for Rand and any other special interest group, Bilderberger, whomever, to run our country and take our freedom from us, is that we don't want that responsibility that goes with freedom. We just want the rights. But we don't want the responsibility. Both of those.
I agree with you, and I think that's part and parcel of what's happened with the spread of rational choice theory. Because when you become a consumer, you're just thinking of yourself. You're just thinking of what's going to be, you know, self-gratifying. What can I get? But I believe, and you can talk to your parents and your grandparents, I believe Americans weren't always like that. That we Americans used to have a sense of responsibility, of civic duties, that yes, we had certain rights, but we also had certain obligations. And that's why people went to town meetings. That's why they bothered to vote. That's why they bothered to be informed. And that's why, you know, they had a sense of a collective sense of belonging that I think is those are the ties that are dissolved by rational choice.
Well, that's the theme, Soldiers of Reason, the Rand Corporation and the Rise of the American Empire. Alex Abeya, thank you so much. Enjoyed the conversation quite a bit.
No problem. Listen, if readers want to see a little bit more and they want to read a chapter, they could go to my website at alexabeya, that's A-B-E-L-L-A, alexabeya.com, and, you know, read a sample chapter and, you know, send me an email and, you know, I'll respond.
Oh, there you go. In the meantime, see you tomorrow night. Deus Tiamat, and I do too.